Energy Transition, episode number 58. Our topic today, petrodollar demise. Good morning, Irina Slav, Tammy Nimet, David Blackman.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hello.
Please let me share with you all, the audience, of course, a very short video, 30 seconds. Let me.
Before the U.S. dominated the world reserve currency status, there were others that eventually ended, like France, which held the reserve status from 1720 to 1815, followed by Great Britain from 1815 to 1920. The US dollar became the world reserve currency shortly after that, with the creation of what's called the Bretton Woods Agreement. Alliances like the BRICS nations, which represent 31.5% of the world's GDP, are also getting stronger as more and more countries are wanting to join.
It's also possible to have more than one large reserve currency. There have been times when that was the case.
Yeah, that's the first point I would like to address here. What are the reasons for the possible de-dollarization? And Irina, you think that are Western sanctions the most significant factor?
Yes, I do believe they are the most significant factor without question. I'm not the only one. Please excuse my voice. I'm having a cold for a change. You know, it's spring. Sanctions are, I believe, the single biggest reason for this backlash against the US dollar. And while the sanctions against Russia definitely, tipped the cup of patience, it wasn't just that. I remember reading about U.S. sanctions on Venezuela and freezing Venezuelan gold assets abroad, just like that. And I kept wondering, what are other countries other than Venezuela thinking at this point, if they can literally arrest a country's gold reserves that have been, sent for safekeeping abroad? If it could happen to Venezuela, it could happen to anyone else.
Anyone.
Same with Iran, same with every country that has been sanctioned by the United States and the European Union. But the sanctions against Russia, the West really overdid it. Russia is currently the most heavily sanctioned country ever in history, in the world, ever. Thousands of sanctions have been leveled against Russia. And the Russian economy is going to register growth this year because the point of the sanctions was to collapse the Russian economy. And this is clearly not happening because the European Union and the US federal government clearly have no idea what is happening in Russia economically and what has been happening for the last 30 years. So they decided to, bring out the big cannons, sanction away. And they thought there will be no response, not just from Russia, but from other countries. They did the same, like what they did with Venezuela. They literally arrested Russian foreign currency assets in the West. What is every other country outside the West going to think, even in the West? Imagine now, for example, the French president went to China and started talking about the European Union basically distancing itself from the United States. It's unthinkable. And I don't know why he said it, what he was thinking. But I'm sure there are people in France thinking, wait, what if the US decides to sanction us?
Right.
It's not out of the question. I mean, this administration has been really sanction happy. So yes, the sanctions are causing a reaction in other parts of the world. People are taking steps to, to basically protect their economies from potential future U.S. sanctions. It's really very simple to me.
Tammy and David?
Yeah, I agree. If you look at it, it's not just using other currencies, it's also how you exchange them. So the big thing was they were saying, we're going to cut off the SWIFT system from Russia, and anyone who deals with Russia, you can't use SWIFT. So then China has its own thing called CIPS or SIPS, whatever. And so now the countries are using that instead. So it's not just that they're going to sanction and you can't use US dollars or you can't do this, you can't do that. It's also the means of trading it. So in this alternative to SWIFT is the Chinese one. And what I find interesting is that, of course, China's embracing all this because if they wanted to make a move on Taiwan and the rest of the world would say, oh, we don't like what you're doing, we think we want to try and sanction you, they've created this great insulation now where they have these other trading mechanisms. They've developed the technology where they can bypass the SWIFT system. They have their own system now. So it makes it much easier for China to exert its influence and power on the world stage, in large part because of what America's been doing, as Irina pointed out, with Venezuela, with Iran, and now Russia.
Yeah, and as Irina pointed out, too, when the United States, what the United States has essentially done with the Russian sanctions is wield currency as a weapon of war. And as you said, if we can do that to Venezuela, do it to Russia, do it to Iran, then we can do it to anyone, theoretically. The other point about to make is that China, as Tammy said, has its own alternative to SWIFT. China and BRICS also have established about 10 years ago, and it's grown since, their own alternative to the IMF. Yeah. And so if the United States moves to cut off access to a country's funds that are held at the IMF, well, BRICS has an alternative now. And as that video at the top pointed out, BRICS currently represents 31.5% of the global economy. And if it does add substantial number of new members, including potentially Saudi Arabia in September, it's going to control a lot more than that. Mm-hmm. So we don't know, I think, and I have an interview that'll be published this week with Anas Al-Haji, who's a really smart, brilliant economist in the energy space and always has tremendous data. We don't see yet any substantial diminution of the use of the petrodollar in international trades for oil. What I don't think we know yet is what the impacts of BRICS expansion and this increasing number of transactions now that we've seen recently being used or using currency other than the dollar may have on the dollar's influence in the future. There's a lot of factors that fly around all this. You know, China and Saudi Arabia both are holders of a great deal of American currency, and a lot of other countries, including France, are as well. And so a sudden collapse of the petrodollar would have, you know, obviously terrible economic impacts on the United States, but it also would have extremely negative economic impacts on all these other countries who are holding and continue to hold U.S. dollar as a reserve currency for international trades. So it's a highly complex issue with a lot of moving parts, and the geopolitical implications of it, you know, are immense. I mean, as we record this today, right now, in real time, China basically has Taiwan surrounded, conducting, quote, military drills, in which they are mocking up an invasion and an attack on Taiwan. So things are getting pretty tense out there. And this currency war that really the United States and EU and NATO really started a year ago in response to Putin's invasion of Ukraine could be a major, major issue in the months to come.
But what's the real reason to have too many sanctions applied? Is this kind of angry with so many countries? What's the reason? What's the base of this
thing? Well, nothing else worked. Regime change couldn't work.
Right.
It failed repeatedly, and disastrously in Venezuela, a country where you think the people do not support the government, and there were mass protests on the street, and this opposition leader that rose to prominence, and nothing happened. So in Russia, it's completely different. And still, regime change is impossible. I mean, externally caused regime change in Russia is not going to happen. They just do not have other weapons or tools, if you want to be more pacifistic. And besides the U.S., sorry for interrupting you, Tammy.
No, it's okay.
I think the U.S. has gotten so used to the idea that they can use their superbly developed and highly complicated and very, very influential financial system to exact punishment against other nations. I think this has led to a certain hubris.
Yes.
That's a good, yeah. And plus, they don't want to actually engage in a real war.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Right? Yeah. So it's like, if they can,
that wouldn't look good.
If they can wield the sort of financial weapon rather than an actual military engagement, then that's the alternative to be chosen. Is it a matter of managed decline to some extent? Maybe. Was the dollar going to decline anyway? That's a reasonable question to ask.
Good question.
That's a good one. David, do you believe that petrodollar or dollar will demise, really demise, or will stay? Mm.
You know, I'm not an expert in any of that. I mean, I think that there's cause for concern, but there's been cause for concern in the past, and things tend to stabilize. I mean, I completely agree, by the way, with the comment about U.S. hubris, and not just the U.S., but the EU as well. The hubris is massive, but I do think the United States, because of the role it assumed post-World War II, it all goes back to the role the United States agreed in negotiations with Europe, the European countries, to assume the role as the policeman of the earth, to keep shipping lanes open, to ensure free trade could happen, with a special focus on the Straits of Hormuz, to ensure the free flow of oil out of the Middle East, and all those implications, everything that's involved with that, you know, depending on who's been president at the time, our country's willingness to abuse that role in the way I think we probably have with what's currently going on in Europe has ebbed and flowed. I mean, we saw a Trump administration try to pull back from a lot of that. And now we have this president who's, you know, he's been in Washington for 50 years. He's an old school warmonger, and there's a lot of warmongers, a big faction in the United States Congress egging him on, and it's a bipartisan faction. And so it just kinds of ebbs and flows. And, you know, the impacts, I'm afraid that this current administration doesn't really think everything through before it acts on these things. And I guess I should add, too, at the end of these comments, that I am in no way defending what Russia has done with Ukraine. It's an atrocity. It's a human rights atrocity. You know, there's no question Vladimir Putin's a war criminal that on a scale of a really almost a Hitlerian scale, certainly a Stalin scale. And, you know, there were reasons to do all this, but the way it's been managed has been pretty poor by the United States, I think.
And
so I feel very strongly always.
The elimination of petrodollar can hurt other countries, not only in the U.S. So who wins and who loses in this case?
I think China wins in the longer term, because it allows it to wield its power more broadly. So if you have to be dependent on another currency in order to secure strategic assets or, you know, strategic materials like oil and gas and whatnot, if you have to rely on another currency, then that makes you vulnerable. And by getting diminishing the power of the petrodollar and being able to use the petro yuan, then that gets the United States out of what China wants to do. The other countries, like, for example, when the leader of Kenya was saying, you know, we're having trouble getting a hold of dollars in order to make our transactions to purchase oil and gas, they're just going to use the Kenyan shilling or whatever their currency is. And so people were saying, wow, look, Kenya's not going to use the dollar anymore. I don't know if they won't use it. It's just that it's now open to use other currencies. Now, maybe it becomes a point where these developing nations can, if they're finding it difficult to get a hold of dollars, that they can use their own currency, maybe. I don't know. But I think in the long run, it's a benefit. It's a benefit for China.
I think that's right. I completely agree with that. I mean, China stands to be the big beneficiary. It will have to figure out how to manage the impacts from its, you know, the fact that it holds so much American currency right now and American debt. But if it really wants to move aggressively in that direction and can succeed, and certainly, you know, in coordination, I think, with BRICS, it certainly has a lot of geopolitical influence to lean on and leverage. And so, yeah, but at the end of the day, if they can manage it right, they could certainly be the main beneficiary.
Irina, specifically for Saudi Arabia, a candidate for BRICS, I suppose, which received a friendly visit from the American president a few months ago, 1 year ago, I don't know. Why? 1 year ago. Why are they so bold, so aggressive now?
Because I think they've had it with the Biden administration. I mean, Biden himself and his officials haven't exactly been subtle in their communication with the Saudis. What they seem to want is to preserve the status quo that has existed more or less since the end of the Second World War, or when petrol was first found in Saudi Arabia. You know, the U.S. provides the currency to make sure that Saudi oil trades internationally, and the Saudis promise to only trade it in dollars. And strategic relationships, military support for the Saudi army, et cetera, but Saudi Arabia seems to be changing. I didn't believe this would happen, but it is apparently happening. Saudi Arabia is starting to look in more than one direction for geopolitical and trading partners. It is forging closer ties with China and with Russia. And I don't think the Saudi ruling elite currently likes America very much right now, because let's remember that Biden came into office swearing to turn the Saudis into a pariah state. That's not something you forget, even if you're very friendly and open-minded. And I don't think the Saudi kingdom is very liberal and open-minded. You know, these things tend to rankle. And then Biden went there on a visit and tried to make it look that, like, everything is still very friendly and both countries are on the same page, but they weren't. And then he started threatening again. He started threatening OPEC. And Saudi Arabia is the leader of OPEC. So essentially he was threatening Saudi Arabia that there will be consequences. Give us more oil or else. This is what the discourse coming out of the White House boils down to. Do what we want or else there will be consequences. So, you know, if I were in the place of the Saudis, I would have said enough, you know, stop it already. So because there are other countries that want to trade with us and they're not telling us what to do, at least not so bluntly, perhaps.
Yeah. So Tammy, is less market interest, is more ideological, I don't know, attitudes.
Yes, I think so. I mean, the problem with the Biden administration are the people who are advising, who are running the show. Because I really don't know if Biden is cognizant enough to be doing a lot of this stuff. So if you look deeper in who's doing the advising and whatnot, there seems to be a lot of people who were from Obama's administration. And Obama's administration had really been pushing this revitalized relationship with Iran. Right. And Iran and the Saudis don't really get along. And I'm sure the Saudis were thinking, what are you doing? I mean, we're supposed to have this special relationship. And now you're trying to cultivate this stuff with Iran. And, you know, maybe the Saudi Arabian announcement in China, the revitalization of various relationships and so on, was a sort of warning to America, like, this is what the situation you're creating, and we need you to do something different than what you've been pursuing for the past 2 years. And I don't know if it would seem that America hasn't got the message. I mean, there's still another month maybe before things are finalized that America can do something. But I don't know. Saudi Arabia is now negotiating with Yemen to stop the conflict that's been going with the Houthi rebels there, and which of course are backed by Iran. And, right. You know, this kind of normalization between Saudi Arabia and Iran, because America has been pushing the whole Iranian thing. So it's a mess. It's a mess right now. And things are, it's like the fog of war, right? It's all uncertain where this is all going.
Yeah, it's really a shame. I mean, it's as if this administration has intentionally sought to destroy our country's relations with Saudi Arabia, to do them harm, to push Saudi Arabia away and into the China orbit, which is where they would naturally move, right? I mean, what else would they do? Right. And, you know, I don't understand the motivations behind it, quite honestly. I mean, I think there are some obvious things to be said about that, given Biden's own history with China, that I probably shouldn't say on this podcast. But, you know, where is Saudi Arabia going to go? They're going to go to China, going to go to the BRICS alliance. I think they'll probably apply for membership there for the September meeting. And once that happens, then, you know, anyone thinking you can preserve the status quo for the United States in the Middle East is living in a fantasy world.
Well, is this related to the energy transition? I hate to be repetitive. I've said this a few times now, but if America and Europe, Western Europe and the Western world says, okay, we're not going to use oil anymore, then what's Saudi Arabia going to do? What are the oil producers going to do? Why should they continue to trade in the dollar? Why should they continue to care about what America or Europe or anyone they have to say when they're saying we don't want to use your product anymore? So do we take the Western countries at their word? I mean, the EPA apparently is going to have some new regulations for automobile emissions that will essentially ban cars.
Yeah.
So what does that mean for the biggest car market, one of the biggest car markets in the world, to say, well, you know what, we're not going to have those anymore that run on petroleum. So what should the Middle Eastern countries do?
Yeah, that's right. It's a French guy asking us.
Luca.
He's Swiss.
Well, some Americans, excuse me, seem to still grant President Biden some shred of credibility. The Saudis are much less gullible. Well, yeah. Yeah. I mean, and we talked, alluded to the fist bump last August a little bit ago. I mean, that moment right there essentially discarded 75 years of careful diplomacy that had gone on between those two countries. And to refuse to shake the hand, regardless of the reasons behind it, to refuse to shake the hand of the de facto leader of a sovereign nation is an incredible insult to people who are very proud of their own country. And it's not something the leader of the United States should be in the habit of doing on an official visit to that country. And I think so much of this stems from that moment in time. And I think historians, if there are any honest historians left in the coming decades, will look back at that moment as a real sea change. Yes, Tammy, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to insult you.
Just one, please.
Yes.
Just one. But it goes back to what we were saying before. I mean, when America starts doing these sanctions, they're no longer a trusted partner. And the globally, whether it's with the sanctions or wanting to wield finance instead of an actual military engagement, but the message is getting through to Saudi Arabia and the other countries that I don't know what's going on with America, but they're not who they used to be anymore and can't necessarily be trusted.
Yeah, trust them.
Yeah, if you're a government in a developing nation, who's a more stable, reliable, and predictive partner for development? Is it the United States or is it China? Well, as of today, looking at it from their perspective, I mean, I think the answer is pretty obvious for those countries. And that's why we're seeing this movement now. And, the United States has lost, as Lucas said, a lot of credibility with these leaders of other countries who need to look out for their own national interests and not the interests of the United States, message to Joe Biden and his political appointees.
The weakening of petrodollar, you see that can bring risks for the world stability?
The weakening of the petrodollar?
Yes.
I don't really know. I'm definitely not a specialist in foreign exchange trading or currencies.
So strong,
banking. But, I've been seeing on Twitter people commenting that the last two people who wanted to ditch the dollar were Colonel Gaddafi of Libya and Saddam Hussein, and look what happened to them.
Yeah.
I mean, the U.S. does not look kindly on such initiatives. But this time it's not just a single country. It's not even a single country that you can accuse of dictatorship and then invade and depose of the government. So it's a little bit more complicated. I don't know about the future of stability. It would depend on all the players in this game of dollars.
But too many different countries with different, they had conflicts in the past. How can they be friends nowadays? So
There are no friends in geopolitics. This is an axiom.
Interests.
There are just common interests and mutual benefits. Not really. Right. I mean, let's be real, not try to take moral high ground or be fantastical like climate activists. You don't have friends. You only have partners, be they traditional or new. And look at what's happening with Saudi Arabia and Iran. If this is possible, it means that these two countries have found something in common. They have found a common interest. Perhaps this common interest is a more peaceful Middle East. And a more peaceful Middle East without the war in Yemen would be a better business environment. It will attract more investments. That's purely pragmatic off the top of my head. Perhaps they have other considerations. I wouldn't know. I don't know. But that's one way of looking at it. That's the way I look at it.
But what's interesting, Irina, is that when you say that, the United States before wasn't in the same sort of debt position it's in now. And it had, its economy was relatively strong. The level of debt was not nearly what it is now, which is insane.
Yeah,
so when you have that level of debt, it really limits the ability to...
Only $30 trillion is not too much.
Well, that doesn't include our unfunded obligations. like Social right. Security and Medicare.
Mind-boggling.
Wow. It's mind-boggling, yeah. And Canada is in a terrible position. For the first time, we're over a trillion. Little Canada. It's crazy. And yeah, so I mean, if you're...
Sorry to interrupt you.
That's okay. So like, you know, 30 years ago, 20 years ago, the United States economy was in a much different position than it is now. So for it to try and, you know, if the petrodollar weakens and people don't want to use the dollar so much anymore, and they've inflated their currency so terribly, there's potential knock-on effects that we can't anticipate that won't necessarily be positive.
Yeah. David, do you believe that with the new election in the United States, and if Republicans win this game, it can reduce wars and sanctions and de-dollarization or not?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we saw in... Look, I wish Donald Trump wasn't running, okay? So let me just say that first of all. I don't want him to run for re-election, but I guess it's inevitable. But during his administration, we saw an entirely different set of circumstances, not just for the United States, but for the world, because we had an administration that was not looking for conflict, was looking for ways to avoid conflict, looking for ways to back away from all these never-ending wars in the Middle East, which, in Afghanistan, Iraq, our involvement in the conflict in Syria, in which the United States government literally created ISIS and initially funded it. All these things that Trump came in and saw, you know, we don't want to be doing, don't need to be doing. And towards the end of the administration, resulted in the Abraham Accords, you can really take a look at, peace was breaking out all over in the Middle East, until the 2020 elections happened. And then beginning on January 21st, 2021, that all began to change. So, yes, I mean, the nature of the American presidency and who's in the White House makes a huge difference in all of these things. And, Vladimir Putin didn't invade Crimea during the Trump administration. He didn't invade Ukraine during the Trump administration. He does it when the United States is weak and projecting weakness and economic weakness. And, he does it when he believes he has geopolitical leverage, which he clearly did, although he overestimated his military's own competence when he executed that invasion. But, short answer, yes. Who's in the White House makes a huge difference in all of this, and hopefully that will be someone else come January 2025 if we manage to get there still intact.
Danny, the BRICS are planning to grow. As David said, on September, they will have a meeting to include more countries. Could the U.S. and the EU reduce this movement? I mean, mitigate the problems with this BRICS growing?
That's a really good question. I'm not sure. I think there's certain... there's certain elements within the European government who like the idea of this counterbalance that it somehow undermines the strength of the United States, which bothers the Europeans that the United States has been as strong. They always refer to it as a hegemon and so on. And so I think they'd be happy with an organization that undermines the United States' economic strength, honestly. But that's my viewpoint, especially when you see what Macron was saying to President Xi. Europe needs to not be so dependent on the United States military. They were talking about how they need to build up their own military. With what money? With what money? They can't even meet their NATO obligations. And now suddenly they want to be the policeman of their corner of the world. Like, sure.
Sure.
Okay. Yeah, they can't even fund their retirement savings, which is
whatever's left from the LNG imports, Tammy. That's what they use.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I know. So, I mean, the BRICS, I think they're seeking ways to prosper. And it seems like, as we've been talking about with the energy transition, the Europeans and the Western powers are talking to the BRIC countries and saying, we don't want you to have reliable energy. We want you to use renewable. We want you to be green and everything. And the BRICS are seeing that as not being feasible for their national interest. And so, you know, they have their own needs to be taking into account and not necessarily what the Europeans and the Western powers want them to do. So, yeah.
Very good. So, and at the same time, David, the third world, the developing world that Brazil is in part of this, are demanding more oil and more, the economy is growing for them.
Sure.
So what the consequence in terms of petrodollar and energy security? What do you see with this developing of countries?
Well, I mean, if the United States continues to invoke these policies that kills off its own usage of oil and gas and its own production of oil and gas, which this administration is clearly trying to do, then the United States' interest, I would assume, in maintaining the petrodollar status will also begin to fade, and to protect that status will begin to fade. And we may be starting to see the early stages of that from this administration. And so, you know, the consequences of that, of the United States not being the reserve currency of the world, will be that trillions and trillions of U.S. dollars will flood back onto the market, creating massive inflation in the United States and devaluing the currency, which could be a goal of this administration. I don't think we can discount that potential. So it's a very interesting time we're living in here. And, you know, we've seen these kinds of things happen in other countries in recent decades, like Venezuela, where you have hyperinflation and you see what happens to the economy and personal freedoms when that takes place. So, you know, I mean, to Tammy's point earlier, this all is interrelated to the energy transition and to U.S. energy transition policies. And if they're carried too far too fast, the consequences can be incredibly severe.
Well, David, do you think, like, with the, if there's hyperinflation and because of the dollars coming back on and whatever, could you see the possibility, could a digital currency sort of be used or said to be used to address the hyperinflation? Because if you're controlling the money through a digital currency the way China does, where there's expiry dates on the money, and that there's Fed now doing its own digital currency that people can use.
Is that just a coincidence?
Yeah.
Is that mere coincidence that Treasury is planning its own digital currency that China has used so ably to implement a very draconian social credit score system, because, you know, a digital currency enables the government to track every financial transaction. You can't use cash anymore. Yeah, is that all just a coincidence? I don't know. I kind of doubt it. I don't really believe in coincidences like that. So,
well, and Europe says it, they're going to have their own digital currency ready to roll out in September.
Yeah, and there's nothing good that can come of that, and people just go on with our daily lives.
Do you think they'll still go ahead with it after that interview with Zelensky that Christine Lagarde had recently, you know, when she got pranked and was really, really talkative and honest about it?
Oh, I didn't hear that. So what did she say? What did
she
say?
You didn't know?
No, well, I didn't hear that.
No, there's a media blackout on all that in the United States and Western.
No, it was on Twitter. Two Russian pranksters
on Twitter,
pranked her. Yeah, right. And imagine that she believed she was talking to Zelensky, and Zelensky was asking her about the digital currency, and she really spilled the beans. Yes, we want to control all transactions over 300 or 400 euros.
Right. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. We're going to do that. Yeah. So now that this video is out all over the internet, maybe they will reconsider.
I don't see.
But she said it. I mean, she said it straight out. They want control over transactions.
Strange.
For security reasons, of course.
Right. So the clip I saw, and maybe it's related to the same thing, or she was talking about something else. But she said, "Oh, we had all those terror attacks in France and Europe, and they were using these prepaid cards, these little smaller transactions, in order to get money. And so it's just better if we can control and see where all this money's coming from and where it's going." And I'm thinking, you have Interpol, you have all these other groups. Yeah. Usually when there's an attack, they've been known to authorities. I've seen that a lot with the German attacks and the French attacks and so on. So it's not like they don't know who the people are, but somehow they need to control and monitor everybody's transactions.
Too much power for
well, you can't engage in profiling now. You can't act intelligently and actually, you know, use the information you already have in your possession to profile people. And so you have to pretend that you don't know and implement these society-wide measures so that you can maintain that pretense, right? And pretend your law enforcement can't do the job otherwise.
Yeah, good point.
Look at
the BRICS countries know full well that a transition away from fossil fuels is very simply put, a transition back to energy poverty. Yes. The U.S. and Europe are the petri dish for this deadly experiment. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. I think that's right.
Yeah. And the net zero and energy transition, the reduction of a petrodollar can affect this project.
That's very interesting, because I'm thinking about this recent deal where a French company bought a cargo of LNG from China and paid in yuan. What if China starts asking for payments in yuan for its solar panels, for example,
right,
or the rare earths that it exports, or everything else transition related that it exports? There's nothing that can stop it from doing it. It won't do it, of course, because as David said, it holds a lot of dollars and a lot of US debt. But hypothetically, you never know.
Yeah, and we're still going to be importing all that from China, right? Yeah. I mean, this thought that you're going to liberate supply chains of all these things from China, China just proved that ridiculous in February when it basically locked up all of Bolivia's lithium, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, you're not going to be able to accomplish that. So, yeah, I mean, we're always going to be vulnerable. As we've discussed in past episodes, we're in the process of changing one energy insecurity, one form of energy insecurity, a reliance on Russia and the Middle East for crude oil, with a different set of energy insecurities, a reliance on China for all the critical minerals and solar panels required for renewable energy.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And what do you think in terms of rise of oil price? What influenced more, petrodollars or petroyuan? The same?
Wow.
That's a good question.
I'm not sure it's price sensitive. I'm not sure any of this, I'm not sure the price matters.
Not the control.
But I'd have to think about that. I haven't ever thought about that.
Yeah, it seems more to do with demand and perception, whatever the security perceptions are of what's going on in the world. And it's like all these discussions that have been circulating the past week or so about de-dollarization. And I'm always cognizant of who's saying what, when. Because when they first started having the conversations in mid-March, when China was making these deals in yuan, there was like radio silence. And so now I'm of the opinion that if Jim Cranmer or whatever his name is off MSNBC starts saying something, I'll do the opposite, or exactly, believe the opposite, you know.
A lot of people feel this way.
But so now when you have, was it, you sent the clip of Fareed Zaharia, whatever, from CNN, and he was talking about it. And so you have the people who really are something of mouthpieces of the deep state, or however you wish to describe it, when they start introducing these ideas as maybe this is some, the trajectory we're headed to, then there's something to it. And you know, what are they trying to prepare people for? Because if you have, it's a confidence game. And finance is very much a confidence game, where if you start telling people that the banks are in trouble, they'll pull their money out. If you start to say that the dollar's a problem and people aren't going to hold it, people are going to dump their dollar or something. So are they trying to manage this now? I don't know.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. When you see anyone on MSNBC, CNBC, or CNN introducing thoughts like that, those stories don't just come up in the newsrooms, right? They're fed to these people by the government, usually by the intel community, which many of them are operatives of. God, what a conspiracy theorist I am. But it's all true. I mean, it's all public information.
Yeah.
I mean, look at the lineup of contributors on CNN and MSNBC. It's like two-thirds of the contributors are former agents or leaders of the CIA and the FBI U.S. intel agencies. It's just, it's like mindset. Those are just the megaphones for the deep state. And so, yeah, when I see someone like, for, you know, anybody on, not just Zaharia, but anybody on CNN saying something like that, I'm like, oh, gee, you know, this is the government. It's just a narrative. It's just a new narrative that they're being fed. And so you just have to take it all and understand where it's coming from.
Very good. 47 minutes was a record of our conversation. Was great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Have a
thank
good
you, Armando. Week. Thank you, David. Thank you,
Arena. Thank you.
Thank you, audience, for putting up with us for so long.
That's great.
Y'all have a great week.
You too.
See you next week. Bye.
Bye.